Welcome to another episode of Focal Point. My name is Chris DeBoer. I am the Executive Director of Reform Perspective Foundation. On today's podcast, we are hoping to discuss a number of issues surrounding COVID-19. And joining me in that discussion is a medical doctor, Julian Vanderpoel, a general practitioner currently working in the Fraser Valley of British Columbia. Now, Julian's a committed Christian, a loving husband, and a dedicated dad to his four girls. Thanks for joining me today, Julian.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Julian, I think it's fair to say that people in the church are quite passionate about some of these issues surrounding COVID-19. There seem to be some who deny the seriousness of the disease, while others seem to accept the public narrative without any discernment. So my goal today is to get your perspective on COVID more generally, and then on the vaccines more specifically, especially as a Christian medical practitioner. I suppose it should go without saying, Julian, these are your well-considered opinions, but they're not meant to be taken as personal medical advice to anybody specifically. And of course, you and I are both open to changing our opinions in the light of new evidences. So, Julian, I'd like to start kind of right back at the beginning of COVID. It's been just over a year now, at least in North America and Canada. Can you just briefly explain what actually is COVID-19 and what does it stand for?
Sure. Yeah, you can do a bit of a review. COVID-19, it's been quite a year. It stands for Coronavirus Disease 2019, which was the year that this all started, right at the end of 2019, is when the virus started in China. So COVID-19 is the name for the disease, I guess, caused by the virus. The virus itself, the technical name for it is SARS-CoV-2. And the reason they gave it that name is because the virus is most closely related to is SARS-CoV-1, which many people will remember this, the SARS epidemic in 2003, which also started in Asia and spread to Toronto before it was contained. So that's sort of the most closely related virus to the current one. Most coronaviruses are pretty minor. They just cause the common cold, but some of them are more serious.
So that helps when you make that comparison to SARS. Indeed, I think I do remember the 2003 discussion of SARS. So viruses clearly spread, and SARS being an example. I don't know if H1N1 is any relation to that, but viruses spread, and COVID seems to be spreading more rapidly, let's say, even than SARS 2003. So maybe can you comment how has COVID spread, and maybe explain, if you can, why has COVID spread seemingly much more rapidly and aggressively than let's say SARS 2003?
It a lot of it depends on the characteristics of the virus, right? So it's interesting to contrast COVID with SARS, because they're very similar to viruses, right? It was strange last spring watching COVID spread from China to every corner of the globe, right? It was incredible to watch. And not all viruses have that potential, right? SARS was contained in less than a year. One of the big characteristics of the COVID virus that allows it to do that is that it can spread with minimal or even no symptoms, which makes it extremely difficult to contain, right? The thing with SARS is it was actually caused much more serious disease. In general, people got much sicker and it had a much higher mortality rate, but that actually makes it easier to identify your patients and isolate them and contain the spread, right? But COVID, it has the ability to sort of spread silently, which allows it has allowed it to spread around the world, right? So it has that characteristic that some viruses have, but others don't. So it's deadly enough to be a problem, and yet spreads quite easily.
Okay, interesting. I think when you describe the 2003 SARS, you use the word endemic. And we hear some people today talk about how this is or is not a pandemic. Some people talk about propaganda. Some people talk about a plandemic. And I just wonder, medically, has the definition of a pandemic changed over the years? And from a medical perspective, if something is identified as a pandemic, what implications does that have? Are there different protocols in place? Once something is identified, classified as a pandemic, that means the medical profession takes certain protocols.
Yeah, good question. I'm not a public health expert or an epidemiologist, but I think I can sort of take a stab at it. A pandemic, it's just a new disease that spreads around the world. If it doesn't spread very far, you would call it an epidemic if it stays more locally. But if it spreads everywhere, then it sort of meets the criteria of a pandemic. So, right, COVID was declared a pandemic last spring, I think March 11th, because at that point it became pretty clear that it was going to spread everywhere. So I'm not really sure, I think it's pretty clear that COVID meets the definition of a pandemic. So, maybe people have trouble sort of wrapping their heads around it being a pandemic because it's sort of a strange and unfamiliar thing. People use the word unprecedented, right? So it's hard for us to make sense of it. But the reality is there's been lots of pandemics throughout history, right? The most recent one was, you mentioned earlier, H1N1, swine flu pandemic in 2009, right? So that was also a pandemic, right? And it didn't carry nearly the same death toll that COVID has. The most serious one probably in recent memory would be HIV/AIDS is also considered a pandemic, and actually has a much higher death toll than COVID has so far.
So, just to clarify, a pandemic then doesn't have anything to do with the consequences. It is really only saying it pans the globe. It spread across, but it's not making a declaration about the seriousness of the disease. Is that right?
Not directly, right? It's the point of the WHO declaring a pandemic is to sort of raise the alarm, that people sit up and take notice and prepare. Right. But the pandemics have varying degrees of severity. The H1N1 in hindsight, there was concern that maybe it was going to be worse. It didn't end up being too terribly bad. It was like an extra bad flu season, but right. So it depends. And as far as you're asking about the protocols, public health officials they've got protocols in place for a variety of disasters, earthquakes, floods, also pandemics, right? So, and as we've seen through COVID, those disaster response protocols get administered provincially, right? Each province is running their own COVID pandemic response. So, you know, the WHO declaring a pandemic doesn't really directly change anything in Canada, but it's more meant to raise the alarm.
Right. Okay. Perfect. I'm wondering just now, here we are a year and a bit later than after that initial declaration of pandemic. How are things today on the medical front? You know, we hear about frontline workers, particularly in the medical field, exhausted. We hear about ICUs being full and beyond capacity. I'm just wondering, in your own experience, from what you see and hear, how has COVID impacted your work and the work of your colleagues?
Yeah, it's been a strange year, work-wise, that's for sure. Lots of change, lots of adaptation, some stress, I suppose. Yeah, I think the stress and strain on the medical system, it depends a lot where you are. In BC at the moment, we're on our downslope of our third wave. The third wave here was definitely higher than waves one and two. But our hospitals haven't been overrun, fortunately. The hospital here in Abbotsford where I work, the ICU is full at the moment. We have a shortage of ICU nurses a bit. So that's human resources is also a challenge, but we're not running out of hospital beds or ventilators or anything, or oxygen like you see in India. So I think some of the other, BC's done fairly well throughout the pandemic. I think we fared better than some of the other large provinces. Alberta's struggling a bit right now. Ontario, I think, is still struggling. Quebec had a lot of trouble early on. So, yeah, maybe that gives you a sense of the overall situation. In my family practice, I'm not taking care of any COVID patients directly. Lots of my patients have had COVID. Fortunately, a few of them have ended up in hospital, a few in ICU, but no one in my practice has died from COVID. We've adapted. I do a lot of stuff over the phone, as much as I can, but I'm still seeing people at the office. I'm at the office today. What needs to be done in person needs to be done in person. So we just take our precautions and carry on.
Maybe I can ask you about those precautions. Is that the best way? So we've done a lot of these government shutdowns and social distancing and masks and so on and so forth. And a lot of people question the validity of these so-called restrictions and public health orders right across the country. And maybe you can explain to us why they're imposed. You don't have to tell us whether you agree or not. You know, the point here is not to get anybody into hot water as such. But why are these restrictions being so strongly implemented? Is that really the best way to stop the spread at this time?
Yeah, I mean that's been the goal, I think, of the public health officials. The challenge with a virus, especially a brand new virus, is you don't really have any effective treatments. So you're really left trying to control the spread as best you can. So that's the rationale behind all the restrictions, right? The social distancing and hand washing and masks. And, I think it's hard to know the true effectiveness of each individual restrictions.
Right.
I think all told, they've certainly made a significant difference, some more so than others, perhaps. But I think we all feel it. They do sort of infringe on our personal freedoms. There's a lot of things we can't do that we want to do. So to some degree, it's probably necessary. Where the truth is exactly what restrictions are absolutely necessary, I don't think anyone really knows the answer to that.
No, fair enough. And I think in our own province here in Manitoba, we have seen the numbers go down after a number of months of harsher restrictions. And then we've opened up and we have seen the numbers come back up. So it's not indeed, like you say, where the truth is and the effectiveness of the individual public health orders becomes in a sense, a bit of a guessing game. So I appreciate your response there. Julian, there's been a lot of discussion about treating COVID, a lot of discussion about ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. There's also an article I read on CTV News recently that explained how a COVID-19 antibody treatment is really stuck on hospital and pharmacy shelves because there's no place and plan. There's no plan in place to administer the drug. I don't want to get into conspiracies that are unfounded, right? I think we have to try and speak to what is evident. But I do wonder about how we have been handling the treatment for the sick. You know, from a media perspective, we are really focused on preventing the spread, and you've kind of alluded to why that is. That seems to make good sense. But there does seem to be a lot less discussion on how to treat the sick. So my question to you is, now that we're into this for about a year, are we getting better at treating the sick today because we know more about COVID?
Yeah, good question. A little, I think. There's been many, 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 many studies looking for potential treatments for COVID. I see new ones every week. But unfortunately, very few of them show promising results, or maybe you get some initial results which look a little bit promising, but then on further study, it doesn't seem to pan out. So there just haven't been a lot of effective treatments. In BC, I'm fairly sure the only medication that's really being used routinely to treat COVID patients in the hospital is dexamethasone, which is a steroid, really a cheap old drug. There's a little bit of evidence for an antiviral drug called remdesivir, which I think is also being used in certain situations in hospitalized patients. But apart from those two, I don't think any other medications are being used on a regular basis in BC, apart from the setting of a clinical trial. And that's the unfortunate reality for a lot of viruses, COVID included, is the treatment is primarily what we call supportive, which basically means you assist people's breathing, you give them oxygen, you give them fluids, you put in breathing tubes if necessary, and you support them through the illness until they fight off the virus. And that's primarily true of COVID at this point as well. I don't think patients are being deprived of any effective treatments that are out there because of mismanagement or anything. It's maybe there's rare instances of that, but nothing. I don't think there's anything on a system level of that happening.
Okay, interesting. I recently read an article in the American Journal of Therapeutics that was speaking about ivermectin. And from a layman's perspective, right? And that's how I read them. So very interesting article showing some benefits to ivermectin as a prophylaxis. as well as a treatment. That was a very recent article. And what I found interesting about that article, more even than the results, was that most of the studies were done, let's say, in the East, Egypt, Israel, Saudi Arabia, India. And I think only one study was cited in that paper from Florida. So just interesting that outside of the North American context, there does seem to be a willingness to explore the ivermectin treatment idea. But yeah, that's just for interest sake.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with that one specifically, but I mean, there's just been a massive flurry of research on just a host of potential medications to treat COVID, right? And it's being done all over the world. So it's, I mean, hopefully something will come up down the road, more effective treatments, but it takes a lot of time too, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, and I really appreciate your point about how we're having to treat it with support, right? And that, I think, explains, and has helped me already to understand why the restrictions, because there is no solid treatment. The best way is to prevent the spread. And to do that, we need to practice these social distancings and so on and so forth. So COVID-19, we hear now today about different mutations of COVID. And my question is it fair to say that this was to be expected? Isn't this something true of all viruses? And connected with that, are the mutations or these COVID variants more challenging to deal with? Are they making COVID more severe?
Yeah, COVID is mutating. A lot of viruses do that. Most, if not all, have the ability to mutate, and just the sheer number of cases lends itself to that. The more times the virus replicates, every time it replicates, it has a chance to change slightly. So now there's a whole bunch of variants which are sort of gradually taking hold. So yes, I would say that's more or less expected. As far as are they more challenging to deal with? Yes, in a way. The main challenge that's become apparent over the last few months is that they're more transmissible. They're more contagious. They spread faster. Right, the reproduction value, the R number that the epidemiologists talk about, is higher for the variants. So they become more of a challenge to contain the spread, keep your case counts down and your hospitalizations under control. So yeah, though so far the variants don't seem to be more severe. It'd be nice if they were actually less severe. I think the jury's still out on that, but they don't seem to be drastically different from the original virus, except that they spread more easily.
Okay, so that brings me to that question now of the vaccines. So there's been a lot of discussion around vaccines. Some people, again, have suggested that the definition of vaccine has been changed in order to call these shots that we are using to help prevent the spread of COVID, to call them vaccines. So maybe you could help us understand the difference, say, between the annual flu shot, a measles vaccine, and something like Pfizer or Moderna COVID treatment.
Yeah, I mean, there's different types of vaccines, right? So simply put, a vaccine is just something, a substance that you put into your body, which stimulates your immune system to make antibodies against a disease, which then protect you from getting infected with that disease. So you know, one of the fascinating things with COVID is we've got some vaccines with some pretty new technology. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines use this mRNA technology, which is pretty new when it comes to vaccines. But it's pretty a simple concept when you boil it down. And as far as I'm concerned, they still meet that simple definition of a vaccine. It's just something you put in your body which triggers an immune response. And some of the other COVID vaccines use a bit more traditional vaccine technology. The AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines they use what's called a viral vector. So they use another harmless virus as a vehicle to get the COVID genetic material into your body so you produce antibodies to COVID. So that's a more traditional type of vaccine, right? What you ask about the flu shots and MMR, those are actually different. Again, those are both what's called live attenuated vaccines. So they don't use a different type of virus as a vector. They just use the actual flu virus or the measles virus, but a weakened version of it to stimulate your immune system. So there's a number of different types of vaccines, but they're all the same basic principle. Yeah.
So it's fair to say that AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, Pfizer, that these are vaccines. They're real vaccines. We're not being sold a narrative just in front of it.
Yeah, no, they're the real deal, and they seem so far to be very effective. So it's promising. Yeah, I did come across a very good article on mRNA vaccines from a Christian perspective. So if people are interested, you know, we can provide them with a link. It's from creation.com, Christian Science website. There's a very good article on there about mRNA vaccines if people are interested or have further questions.
Yeah, no, definitely we'll try to provide that in the link or as a, you can put that on the bottom of our screen too. So that leads me to that question then, is the administration of these various vaccines our best way out of our current health crisis? How would you counsel your patients? And to be honest with you, Julian, I'm a little bit in this camp myself, and I wouldn't say afraid, but now I'm concerned about the spread of COVID. I take it seriously. I know in my own church community, two people, and not very old, who are on ventilators or were. I know of other brothers and sisters in Christ who are in hospital and some have been on ventilators and so on. So I take the spread of the COVID very seriously. But I'm also concerned about some of the side effects of the vaccines that have been reported. So how would you generally counsel patients about getting this vaccine? Would you say to someone like myself, I'm 40, Chris, if you have the opportunity to get a vaccine, you should do so. It would be good for you and for the community. Or would you say, yeah. So anyway, I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question, right? And with the vaccine rollouts underway, you know, this is top of mind for people for sure. And I've been in the office, I've been talking to patients every day about the vaccine. So yeah, totally understandable. But yeah, bottom line is, yeah, I think for sure at this point, the available vaccines seem to be by far the best way out of this mess. Right. Just to try and explain the numbers, a little bit, I'll use BC as an example. I think COVID has proven over the last year that it's not going to go away. until the large majority of the has immunity to it somehow. This is this concept of herd immunity, that there's enough immunity in the population that the virus stops spreading, at least in a significant way. So yeah, using BC as an example, about 3% of the population here has been officially diagnosed with COVID so far. Likely the true number is a fair bit higher than that. There's been undiagnosed cases, I'm sure. But ballpark, probably 90% of the population is still susceptible to this disease. So the problem is without people acquiring immunity from a vaccine, it's going to take a long time, and a lot more people are going to have to get sick and die before we get to that herd immunity threshold, right? It could take years and years at this rate, with all these oppressive restrictions in place, right? Or you loosen the restrictions and the virus runs wild. Neither of those seem to be very good options. Whereas if the vast majority of population, if that 90% of susceptible people can acquire immunity by getting vaccinated rather than getting the disease, we can be at herd immunity before the end of the year, right? Or at least it that looks likely at this point. So, right. And unfortunately, like we talked about earlier, the alternative of having some really effective treatments to just treat people, the prospect for that doesn't seem great at this point. So, but that being said, I totally understand why people are a bit nervous about getting a vaccine, especially because they're brand new. I had my two doses of Pfizer vaccine already a number of months ago, and I had it a little bit in the back of my head too. You're getting this brand new vaccine administered to you. I think the bottom line is, so far they seem to be quite safe, right? The main issue that's popped up so far are these blood clots associated with the AstraZeneca vaccine, what's been called vaccine-induced immune thrombotic thrombocytopenia, or VITT, right? I think there's been, I saw today, there's been 28 cases of it across Canada out of 2.3 million doses of vaccine. So I guess that gives a ballpark of around 1 in 100,000. So fortunately, still pretty rare, but serious. Some of these people have died from serious blood clots, and that's not good, right? Some of the provinces have now stopped using the AstraZeneca vaccine until we get more information, right? So that's the main serious side effect that's come out thus far. The interesting part is the mRNA vaccines, which are actually have the newer technology, actually seem to be very, very safe, even though they've only been around for a number of months now. I think over a billion doses of vaccine have been administered worldwide already. So it's incredible that's the numbers involved. So we've had a chance to watch these vaccines being used over the last 4 or 5 months. And so far they seem to be very effective, and they seem to be quite safe. So they've been a game changer for sure.
Yeah, I know. And I said to my wife, I'm not touching the AstraZeneca, but again, that's that narrative from the media. You hear about the risks, and you hear some people who have had the Pfizer shot some hours later apparently are having quite the symptoms for a couple hours, and then they're better again.
Yeah, I mean, those sorts of minor reactions following a vaccination are pretty common. Some people get some pain or discomfort at the injection site. Some people just feel crummy or worn down, tired, sort of flu-like for a day or two. That's sort of, I guess you could call it side effect from the vaccine. It's your immune system is getting activated and ramped up. So that can make you feel a little bit unwell. So it's a side effect. Yeah. But those are relatively minor normally.
Okay. Good. Why are people who are fully vaccinated still required to wear masks and practice social distancing? And that question I posed to you in preparation for our discussion a while ago. It seems now that in the U.S. they seem to be reducing the requirements for masking, just based on main media reports. But why are we who are vaccinated still asked to practice social distancing and mask wearing?
Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, it feels a bit onerous, right? Maybe for some, you know, I think the reason the public health officials are asking us to do that in Canada is because they're concerned that that a vaccinated person could still transmit the virus to others even without any symptoms. That's the right. I mean, the vaccine trials show that once you've been immunized, you're very unlikely to get symptoms, to get a symptomatic infection. But the thinking is maybe you could still have an infection without symptoms and spread it around to others that way. Likely the chance of that is also much, much lower in someone who's been vaccinated. I guess officially we don't have the proof of that yet. I think that's why the officials in Canada prefer that even fully vaccinated people still take some precautions, right? It, as you say, the Center for Disease Control in the U.S. has been a bit more liberal in allowing vaccinated people to take fewer precautions and start to resume some more activities again. I don't know which is the best approach. I guess the former route is the very cautious way, maybe overly cautious. I don't know. The latter route, I guess one potential advantage of doing it that way is it's an additional incentive for people to go and get vaccinated, to be able to loosen some of your precautions a bit, but I don't know.
Hey, Julian, it's been a great discussion. I'd like to end a question a little bit about your faith life. You know, as a Christian doctor, you are a firm believer in God's sovereign good pleasure and his goodness. So how do you make sense of the challenges we're facing today as someone who does put his hope and trust in the triune God?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, it's a broad question. But I think throughout the pandemic, this is what we've all been trying to do. We've been grappling with the situation as it unfolds, trying to understand what's going on, trying to put it in context, trying to figure out how best to deal with the situation. It's been a challenge, right? I think as Christians, we see a number of reactions in the secular world that don't fit with a Christian worldview. So I think we react to those and try and avoid them, right? You know, we've seen so much fear and anxiety about COVID, right? But Philippians says, do not be anxious about anything, right? We see a lot of people grasping for control over the situation, but I think we recognize, myself too, that all of this is in God's control. If you feel you have some degree of control over the situation, over the virus, over your health, it's really just an illusion anyway. So you do need to put some faith and trust in God. Yeah, it's you see a lot of blame too. You see blame flying everywhere in the media, right? People are blaming China for the virus. People are blaming the WHO for the wrong response. You know, again, as Christians, I think we recognize that God created this virus. He unleashed it on the world, and we have to figure out how to respond to it, right? And you know, and as things have gone on and on and on, I think we're starting to see a lot of COVID fatigue, myself included. Everybody's just kind of tired of the situation and would like to move on and get back to normal life. So, you know, I think for myself, I've tried to make my peace with the situation, accept it as a time of testing, maybe painful testing from God. But trust that he has a plan and he will work it for our good, right? As we say in Romans 8. So yeah, that's been my reaction.
No, I appreciate that. I think indeed as Christians, we should indeed accept all things as from God's fatherly hand. So indeed he's working it for good. And we should not let the devil get a foothold in causing division in the church and so on and so forth. So I'm hopeful that our discussion today will help to just bring some clarity into what is COVID, what are the vaccines, why they are a reasonable approach, why these restrictions are in place. The spread is really, if we can control the spread, we can control the virus in that sense. So I really appreciate our time together, Julian. You've given some clarity, at least to me, and hopefully to our listeners. And I want to wish you the Lord's continued blessings in your work. And it's a real blessing to have Christian medical practitioners. And I would encourage others who have the gifts to consider following your footsteps. I'm sure if there are young people who are interested in being a doctor, maybe they can reach out to you because yeah, there might be some anxieties about other things in becoming a doctor, which we could discuss another day. But yeah, thanks so much for your time, Julian. And like I say, I wish you the Lord's continued blessings.
Thanks, Chris. My pleasure.
Take care.
Bye for now.